Well, hello there. This is Marketing in the Raw, the podcast, and my name is Adam Helway. I am the host. I'm so happy that you're spending time with me here. This is the place where we try to expand how you define the practice of marketing and your vision of where it's headed, especially in a digitally connected world. I'm so happy that you're spending some time with me here. Before we get into this episode, I wanted to share a little bit about some of the great episodes that we've already published and put out there that I hope you maybe have had a chance to listen to. Not long ago, we got a chance to talk with Ursula Ringham from SAP about B2B influencer marketing. I talked with Brian Kramer about how small shifts can make a big impact. We got to talk with the chief MarTech himself and HubSpot's own Scott Brinker about marketing technology and how many tools is too many. We got a chance to talk with one of our great friends, Robert Rose, from the Content Marketing Institute about content marketing and how to make it more profitable. There is so much more to explore. If you've already listened to those episodes, thank you so much. And if you are new, if this is the first episode that you've listened to, go check those out right after you listen to this interview. Now, if you're like most of our clients, the path from the start of a customer interacting with you and your brand online all the way through to finally converting and turning into a customer can be quite complex. And these days, that journey or customer journey is getting more and more complex by the day as new ways of interacting with customers pop up. The ability to measure all of that and to understand what elements play a primary and supporting role in that customer journey and where you should invest your time and resources and money, it gets more and more confusing and overwhelming by the day. That's where today's conversation comes in with Chris Penn. He's the co-founder and chief data scientist at Trust Insights and the author of AI for Marketers, a Primer and Introduction. We talk about AI in context to marketing and how AI can help you better attribute credit to your marketing success. We also get to dip into how Chris is probably the first and only official person who can call themselves Marketing Ninja. I'd love for you to take a listen to this interview. Tell me what you think after you heard it. Without further ado, here is Chris Penn. Chris Penn, thank you so much for joining me, man. You don't know this, but I sat in on one of your sessions. I think it was at Inbound a year or so ago. I don't think you and I have had the pleasure of meeting in person, but we run in the same circles, and I really enjoyed that presentation. I think it must have been around predictive analytics or something like that at the time. But you are one of those folks that is known for being a super smart, geeky dude. And I say that with the utmost admiration. You know, some people joke about adding the term guru or wizard or even ninja to the titles, their work titles. But the difference is that you are actually a legit ninja, right?
Yes, I do have a fifth degree black belt in Bujinkan Budo Taijutsu through my teacher, Mark Davis, here in Boston.
Okay, I'll be convinced when at the end of this interview, I see you throw a smoke bomb and then, you know, disappear off the mic. Cool?
That never really happens all that much.
Well, how did you get into martial arts, by the way?
Oh, that goes way back to when I was a kid and got beat up a lot because I was a small kid on the playground. And, you know, after a while, that gets kind of old. And in high school, I took up at the local YMCA this Ishinryu Karate, Okinawan style of karate. And that was fun. Did that for a few years. I got to college and joined the martial arts club there. And, you know, the first day was open sparring. And I was like, I'm almost a black belt at this point in karate. Like, I'm going to do my tournament winning spinning roundhouse kick against this kid who's a green belt from, you know, some ninja school up in Boston. I get up, do my thing. He just steps aside calmly, watches the kick completely miss, just punches me in the face. I'm laying on the floor going, what the hell just happened to me? And he's like, you missed. I'm like, I'm going to do what you do because clearly it works a lot better. And that's how I got into this stuff.
Well, that's very cool. Are there any weapons or anything you've had to learn over the years in doing that?
Tons. Swords, sticks, ropes, chains, bow and arrow, all kinds of stuff. Basically, and a lot of this actually goes to what we talk about in analytics and marketing. You learn these tools, these different weapons, but with the understanding that the principles that guide them are what you're going to probably end up using, because you're probably not going to be carrying around, you know, a Sengoku Jidai era war sword with you. But grabbing an umbrella, if you have to, like, you know, whack somebody upside the head, yeah, you're probably going to have that. You're not going to have ninja throwing stars and stuff, because in some places like where I live, they're actually illegal. But you can absolutely fling a credit card or like that pile of AOL CDs at your desk, you know. And so these principles that you learn can be applied from one context to a next. And the same is true, like, even in marketing. You think about something like, go way back in time. Like, this is way back now. 1968, Bob Stone's direct marketing framework, you know, list, offer, creative. Now, when we talk about like email marketing and social media marketing, the same principles apply. It's a different context. But if you think about the principle, how do I take the principle and apply it? There's an expression in the art martial arts called Onko Chishin, which is Japanese for study something old to learn something new. So when you look at all these old frameworks that you have from marketing back in, you know, the 1800s, we still use one from the 1800s. It's E. St. Elmo Lewis's marketing funnel. Attention, interest, desire, action. Remember, for those of you who watch Glengarry Glen Ross, it was one of the things that Alec Baldwin's character yelled at people. We still use that today. It's over 120 years later, and that's still the basis of a basic marketing funnel.
So then how'd you get into marketing after all this?
I actually got into marketing through technology. So I was a technologist first. My graduate degree is in management of information systems. And in 2003, I joined a small financial services company where I was the CIO and the CTO and the guy who cleaned the restaurant on Fridays. It was a three-person startup. I was number three. And what happened over that decade that I was there was update the web server became update the website. Fix send mail became send the newsletter. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know at the time, nobody knew at the time, but that was the beginning essentially of what we now call marketing technology. And that's sort of, you know, the path I've taken. I've taken a very technology-centric route through marketing and analytics because that's what I knew, but there was a greater need for it in the marketing side of things than there was on the technology side. Now, thank goodness I went that route because, you know, basic technology is all cloud. It's all outsourced. You know, nobody has servers anymore. For the most part, it's all cloud-based, but there's a lot of this marketing technology now.
It was a sort of explosion in that area because I agree with you that most of the technology side of things was centered around server-based stuff and the things related to making, you know, computers do what they needed to between creating websites and managing the IT element associated with that. But now we've got this full stack of tools and you really can't do much in modern marketing without having some tech savviness or some set of tools, whether small or very complicated in many folks' case. So you were on the right path there for suddenly this vast ocean now that is, like you said, MarTech. How about you mentioned analytics a little bit? What got you into there? I mean, being a technically inclined person as I know you are and as you just described, I would imagine that the analytics became sort of an additional extension of that.
It was not so much an extension as it was just required. So again, working in that startup, my boss, who was the CEO, was always saying, well, how's the website doing today? You know, and this was in the days, you know, 2003, you're talking about old programs like AW Stats. And those who have a lot of gray hair remember those days, like, oh, yeah, we hated doing that. After doing the server logs off the server, and processing the logs and things. And then in 2005, everything changed for everybody because Google bought this company called Urchin that made this extremely expensive $5,000 a month analytics program. And what changed everything was they said, you know what? We're going to buy it. We're going to rebrand it, scale it, and give it away for free as this thing called Google Analytics. And that really was the first foray for a lot of us into analytics. Was like suddenly we have this free tool from Google that we can use to track our sites and know what's going on. understanding the, you know, the Faustian bargain we made in the process. Like, Google, here's all our data.
I was going to say, that shows how valuable that data is, right?
Exactly. And then everything that's happened since then has been building on, you know, well, what's happening with my marketing, my social media, my digital, my ad spend? People just keep wanting to know, for good reason, what's going on with their marketing. And these are the tools that help us get those answers.
So let's fast forward a little bit, because you're always on the cusp of all the newer stuff as well, and where things are going. Let's talk a little bit about AI, because part of the discussion today, we want to talk about AI powered attribution. And over at Trust Insights, which you are a co-founder of, you guys do, you know, when people think of analytics, I think the default really is Google Analytics, or it may be the analytics they see inside their email account or something like that, their marketing email account. There are so many other flavors and directions to go with analytics. Let's talk a little bit about AI and then go into the, you know, to the attribution side. I mean, there are two sort of separate things that have a marriage here in what we're going to talk about. We're really, really, really early in the world of AI at the moment, right? And we're really only trying to find out where that utility is, especially when it comes to marketing. What do you think about that? Would you agree?
So AI itself is very old at this point. Artificial intelligence has been a field of study since the 1950s. What is different is that now the tools and the computational power are much more accessible and affordable for everyone. You can run really fantastic, amazing, you know, world-leading software on your laptop. Your laptop has the ability to do that, but especially if you've got one of those really nice gaming laptops, you can do some amazing stuff with that. Or if you don't have that, you can use services like, you know, IBM Watson Studio or Google Colab or any of these SaaS-based software services that allow you to run those very sophisticated algorithms on basically somebody else's computer. Like, let's boil it down. A cloud is just somebody else's computer. What's also different is that as these tools have become more accessible, there are more people looking at these algorithms and saying, how can we apply this from one domain to another? So looking at, for example, Markov chain modeling from the purely academic, and how do we translate that into something that we can use to model attribution within marketing. We're now getting into away from the academic theory and into the practical applications of this. The specific section of AI that we deal with most in marketing is called machine learning, where you take data that exists, you train the machine to recognize patterns in it, and then you say, okay, now predict or attribute or classify new data as it comes in to understand where does it fit or what's likely to happen. So if you have Google Analytics, for example, and you're getting website visitors, is there a pattern in the data that a machine could learn and eventually help you forecast? Okay, if I have 5 years of data, can I forecast with some reasonable certainty tomorrow's traffic or the next day's traffic, or, and so on and so forth? Or if I have a big bucket of data, like, say, customer complaints in your customer service inbox, can you have a machine read all those complaints for you and summarize them? Like, what are the major topics that people complain about? You know, service is too slow, price is too high, server was surly, wrong food was served, whatever the case is. That's all information that can be extracted out from data that sometimes is so big that you can't keep up with it. Like, we have one client that we're working with right now that has a chat bot on their website, and it logs these chats, and they're generating 16 to 20 million of these per day, and they want to know what's trending. Well, no one can read that much, but machines can read through it, classify it, and say, like, hey, this thing here, Toyota Prius repairs because I got to go pick up my car in the shop after this. Toyota Prius repairs are trending right now. Something's going on there. Create some content about that. So that's how AI is being applied. I think it's really important to demystify AI. It is math. It is 100% based on math and probability. There's no magic involved. AI cannot create something that has not been trained to do. You know, we are very far away still from the Terminator, you know, or any of the other fanciful science fiction movies. We're not even at a point where we can, you know, I think the closest example of practical AI that you see is like Star Trek's computer, where you just yell into the air, you know, things happen. Like, you can do that at home now and ask Amazon to order you like more potato chips. And when you listen to how Amazon engineers talk, that was their model. When they were kids, they watched that show. It's like, I want to yell into the air and have things happen. And now we have these smart devices all over our homes that we can just yell into the air and things happen. But we're very far away from what's called artificial general intelligence, where you can just talk to a computer and have it make logical sense back to you.
And you talked about AI in the sense that it's been for some time being more academic, and then now making its way into sort of the general public because it's accessible in the same way that like computing is, right? And having handheld computers and a lot of other things, that's usually how it ends up happening. Do you feel that there's still sort of it's still, that means that it's sort of the challenge here isn't making it accessible, but the challenge is making it something that the average marketer can properly understand, conceptualize, like you said, demystifying it, but then also make it frame it in a way where they can understand clearly how they can use it in their day-to-day operations, where again it had that academic roots, which is a whole different way of thinking about the space.
I think it's that, and if you think about it, a lot of what we're talking about, like algorithms and models and things, these are pieces of software. At the end of the day, these are pieces of software. And so it's like the engine of a car. The engine of a car is really important. I don't think anyone would really contest that, you know, you can have a car without an engine. But the rest of the car is important too. And so a lot of, you know, you literally cannot just sit on an engine. It's really uncomfortable.
I don't want to know how you know that, Chris. I don't want to know how you know that.
Doesn't go very far either. And so you need that other stuff. And that's, you know, to your point, where we are, where it's not just AI and these cool models. It is, how do you apply this in a way that is usable to other people so that there's the obvious business benefit?
So then let's dive into that business benefit, one of those business benefits. You guys at Trust Insights, one of the things that you do, and it's really interesting, is you help folks with AI-powered attribution and analysis related to that. And I would say that one of the most challenging things that seems to always come up for clients, our clients, for when you look at survey reports of what folks are trying to figure out on a year-to-year basis, sort of put their energy into, it's around attribution. Can you explain a little bit about why attribution seems to be a little bit challenging for folks, and why in today's, I would say, very connected world and digitally diverse customer journeys that we have our customers facing, why attribution is just a bit challenging?
So here's the thing about attribution. It's something that's continuing to evolve, right? I mean, think about it. The word itself comes from Latin, ad and tribuere. Oh, I can't pronounce my Latin teacher would be so ashamed of me.
I'll let you pass, man. It's all right. I'll let you pass.
It basically means to give, to assign, to bestow, to give credit, right? We're giving credit to something for something. So when we say we're talking about marketing attribution, of all the places we get traffic or leads or sales, we want to give credit to the various efforts that have led to that outcome so that we know how to resource properly, how to budget properly, how to predict, you know, what's our revenue going to look like in 3 to 6 months if we know what we have in the, you know, our marketing pipeline right now. And the reason it's gotten so challenging is because the world has gotten more complex and our tools have gotten more sophisticated. In the beginning, you know, back in 2005, when Google Analytics first came out, you really had what? Three attribution models, right? You had last touch. So the last thing somebody did, 100% of that got credit. So if you clicked on an email and you signed up for my newsletter, email gets 100% of the credit. Or first touch, you know, you went to a webinar, you saw me at a conference, you opened an email, and that webinar gets all the credit and basically says the other things that happened don't count. And then back then there was what's called linear. So everything gets an equal piece of the credit. Well, we know that just from our own experiences, that's not how people buy. That's not how people buy for anything except maybe very transactional stuff like a pack of chewing gum. Like, you know there's not a buyer's journey that's particularly long for a pack of chewing gum, especially if it's like a three-year-old. It's like, whoosh, grab it.
And, yeah, exactly.
And the journey is over. But for everything that's more complex than that, there is a longer journey. There's sometimes multiple decision makers. There are many touch points. And now with the advent of smartphones, you know, in the last 10 to 15 years, that drastically changes attribution, because now a person, an individual, can be in different journeys at the same time. So real simple example, I was at the mall back when malls were a thing we could go to, you know, prior to 2020. I was watching this person shopping, and they were in the clothing section, and they were pulling this piece of clothing off the rack, and they had their phone open and video chatting with a friend, saying, you know, how does this look? Does this look like a good match for me? And the person's like, yeah. You want me to check the price on Amazon and stuff? And they're going back and forth. I'm like, this person is in multiple journeys at the exact same time. And what a complex model that is for someone to try and figure out. Now, what's happened in parallel with the increasingly complex journey is our increasingly better analytics tools. So we went from last click that somebody did to being able to track all the clicks that, or all the interactions that we have with a customer. And now it's a question of how do we put all that data together so that we can understand which things led to this outcome. And the way that there's a bunch of different ways to do that. Google has a product called Google Attribution, which is based on a machine learning model called Shapley Game Theory. And fundamentally what they do is, the best way to explain it is like a poker game. Like, imagine there's like four folks sitting down at a poker, you know, game, and they're all betting, they're all playing, and then a fifth person sits down. How does the game change when that fifth person sits down? Do some people bet more? Do some people bet less? Do some people fold more? Do some people bluff more? It all depends on that, the interactions of those other channels with that new person at the table. And that's a lot of the way Shapley Game Theory works. Google uses that because it scales very well. But it's got some limitations. The other model the one that we use is called Markov chain modeling, which is more like a basketball game. Like, if you watch the Golden State Warriors, right, and you're seeing Steph Curry shoot three-pointers all day long, somebody's got to get the ball to him, right? Mm-hmm. And so yep. what we acknowledge is that different people are going to be feeding him the ball. They deserve part of the credit for that score because he didn't get the ball right off. You know, it had to be passed. And so if you think about the same context, a webinar, an email, a social media ad, a YouTube video. How do those all count? If you look at the total number of times that last channel scored, right? What were all the assists in just like the basketball game? And then you could start to build an attribution model. Well, the machines do it for us to say, this email is like the number one assisting channel for all the scores, points scored. So email should be given this much credit because it helps assist the most. And it scores some baskets of its own, if you will. But Twitter over here, it doesn't do such a good job. It gets intercepted a lot. There's a lot of turnover. So we're going to give that a very small score because, you know, it can't play basketball. And with these models now, you can start to understand not only what's happened, but the complex interactions between these channels. And that's what marketers are really trying to get a hold of, is not just how many leads did this channel give me, but what is the importance of this channel overall so that I know how well to fund it.
I love that you brought up the basketball metaphor, because it's one that I actually use, and because I'm a Bay Area resident, it almost always ends up being the Golden State Warriors as well. So I feel a little bit validated that you use that, Chris. What's the easiest way for folks to dip their toes in starting to leverage AI powered attribution?
You know, that's a tough question to answer, because it's a lot like saying, how can somebody dip their toes into electrical engineering? Or how can somebody dip their toes into spinal surgery? There are things you can do to start your learning journey, but ultimately, something like AI is no different as a profession, as a discipline, than, you know, professional bread baking or yard tending. You know, everybody can do a little bit of the basics. Like, you know, anyone can make toast, but not everybody's going to be Gordon Ramsay. It's just the way things are.
Let me ask you in this way: how does a marketer or a business know that AI powered attribution is something that would be appropriate for their use case?
The question to ask, or the series of questions to ask, is how complex is your buyer's journey? Like, do you know? When you go into Google Analytics and look at the path analysis, for example, and see how many touch points there are to a sale, if 100% of your transactions are one visit and they're done, you probably don't need a whole lot of complex attribution, right? Because you have a very transactional product or service, and people either buy it or they don't. You could make an argument that there's a problem in the marketing strategy if you have no relationship with your customer. They just come and buy, then they forget that you exist. But from an attribution perspective, that's easy. On the other hand, if you have, you know, sort of that long tail, you know, 80-20 or 60-40, where there's a lot of interactions, then yeah, you're going to probably need more sophisticated attribution analysis. Most people, given the choice, are probably not going to build their own software. So what they'll probably do is rely on Google's model. And Google's model is good if you can interpret the results. The challenge is the results are very difficult to interpret because they spit out in such a way that it doesn't tell a logical, coherent story. It doesn't tell you anything prescriptive. It really is just sort of like, here's the model that you're working with. And I find that very challenging for even a technical marketer to look at and go, I know what I should do when I look at this report. I don't. Whereas a Markov chain model is a little bit easier to understand. It's like, okay, what are the order that channels occur in the most, right? Is organic search beginning, middle of the journey, end of the journey? And then how much of an impact does it have? It's kind of like Jenga. If your conversions are a tower and organic search is the biggest block in that tower, you pull that block out, the whole thing's coming down, right? And so AI-powered attribution, at least for the Markov chain model, is the one that I think is the most useful from a prescriptive perspective. In terms of what the average marketer is going to have happen now and over the next couple of years, you're going to see more of these technologies built into the tools you already use. You know, CRMs like, you know, Salesforce and HubSpot and stuff will be starting to be having some of the stuff be more visible. Google Analytics, for example, you see that be much more visible in product now. So it's a question of, are you looking for it? And if it's there, do you know what to do with it? And if you don't, do you know who you can ask for help?
That's a great tip there. And so in going a little bit further, you were talking about over the next few years, you know, say we're looking over the next five years from now, as AI evolves and helping marketers in this way, how can marketers be prepared? And I know you mentioned sort of like, obviously, keeping an eye open and knowing what resources to tap into in order to help out with that. Is there also a way that they should be looking at their data or filling in gaps where their data has been lacking, so that way they're best prepared when things like that become more accessible or their customer journey becomes more complex where they need to be addressing it in this way?
A big part of preparing for the journey is knowing what you do and you don't have. You know, we actually have this whole 7-step journey to AI framework that we used to coach companies with. And it always starts with, you know, what data do you have? What condition is it in? Are you analytically driven? Are you a data-driven company? Do you have a facility for developing insights? Do you have automation in place? Are you skilled at data science? In terms of what marketers should be looking at to know whether they should have a problem, it really comes down to what questions are you asking of your analytics that you're not getting answers to that are satisfactory right now, right? Once you ask that question of yourself, of your staff, of your tools, and you see where the blind spots are, that's a really good place to start a line of inquiry, because what tends to happen a lot, especially in B2B, is a new tool comes out, a new technology comes out, all of the sales folks start knocking on the door saying, hey, we've got this shiny new thing. And you're like, cool, it's shiny. And then, you know, sometimes you buy it and then you're like, why did I buy this thing? I don't even know what it does. I don't know what problem it solves. Scott Brinker is famous for his, you know, MarTech 8000, this huge wall-sized chart of the 8,000 different companies in the MarTech space. And they're all point solutions. Like, you know, there's a tool for this, a tool for that. And it's like the world's largest buffet. The reason that exists in a lot of ways is because people are not clear about the problems they're trying to solve. So all these point solutions have sprung up to try and patchwork things together, as opposed to taking a step back and thinking strategically and saying, what major analytics questions am I trying to answer that I can't answer right now? Let's figure out a way to solve that. And if you can do that, A, you'll get the answers you want, and B, there's a good chance that other people have that problem too, and you may even be able to turn it into a separate line of business.
What would be your dream AI marketing tool if Chris were to create one? I swear I won't let anybody else know what your idea is. You know, we don't want anybody to steal the idea.
If we're talking dream that has absolutely no constraints on practicality whatsoever, it is artificial general intelligence, right? It is the ability to chat with and interact with a sentient machine. That to me, that's both, you know, kind of dream and nightmare, because one of the things that is a challenge, and this comes up a lot in artificial intelligence, is we have to train AI with data. And in that respect, it's exactly like every other piece of software in the world. Garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah.
Which means that if you know, we see this happening a lot with more sophisticated models. If you train an AI with biased data, you will get biased outcomes. The worst example I've seen of this in recent times was about a year ago at the MarTech conference. And I saw this vendor that had, if it wasn't attribution modeling, it was predictive customer modeling. And they brought up this map of the Boston area, and it was covered in red and black dots. And they said the red dots are ideal customers for, this was for a coffee brand. And the black dots are no good. They're customers you don't want. I'm looking at this map and I'm going, you have almost no red dots in Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, Ashmont. Those are all black sections of the city. Are you seriously going to tell me that black people do not drink your brand of coffee? Like it's a well-known common chain, right? You know, like this is complete BS what this thing has come up with. And they're like, oh no, it's a machine learning model. Like, yeah, what did you put in the model?
Yeah.
How did you train it? Because I said, what you've done is you've replicated redlining, is what you've done, which is illegal. And they're like, what's redlining? I'm like, okay, if you were my vendor, you'd be fired. Because if you don't know what redlining is and you're creating, you know, geographic algorithms, you should be fired, because you are reinforcing biases. You are reinforcing problems that exist in the world instead of solving them to make a better world. When we talk about AI and marketing for attribution, the same things can happen, because if all your customers are one demographic and that's the data you train it on, it's going to keep recommending things that are still in one demographic. And the example I give a lot is My Little Pony, the Hasbro toys. These are typically marketed towards 8 to 14-year-old girls, right? And if you were Hasbro's marketer and you're training on data, that's what you put in the machine. Okay, let's make sure we do this, and we're going to do all this targeting, we're going to have all this attribution modeling and all this stuff to figure out our success in this campaign. But there's a huge segment with much more disposable income of men 26 to 40 that absolutely love this thing. They're called bronies.
Bronies.
It's a whole subculture. There's this Netflix special about them and everything. If you are thinking about, if you're loading data into your system to do forecasting and prediction, and you're not opening your eyes to this substantial, wealthy market, you are cutting yourself off from, you know, up to 20% of your revenue. Why would you do that? Well, you did that because you trained the machine with data and assumptions that were not open to non-traditional possibilities. And that is a danger across all AI. It's something that, as we're building systems, we have to be aware of, that we're going to be reinforcing what's already in the data.
I love that. And this could be a whole conversation to itself, but do you have any advice for folks on how they can avoid that predicament?
There's a whole series of things that you can be doing at like three different levels. So there's the people you hire, right? I personally believe that people, as you hire them, should be screened with Harvard's implicit bias test to understand how good or bad or strong are your biases. And look, that alone is not a condition to not hire somebody, unless it comes out like, you know, they wear, you know, white hooded hats all the time. That's probably a good reason to not hire them. But but you need to understand what you're working with and with the people you have, and what their biases are. And it's, you know, there's a lot of dimensions. There are some people who are biased based on the color of your skin or the religion you are or your sexual orientation or your gender identity. And we got to know that what's inside the heads of our people. There's the processes we have, right? When you get a new data set, how do you inspect it? What tools do you run it through? What are you looking for? Are you screening for bias as the data goes in? Are you screening the models as they're built? Are you screening the outcomes as they happen? So advanced, ad hoc, and post hoc inspection. And finally, there's the tools and the technology. And there are many good tools that are in the space. IBM leads the way with its Fairness 360 toolkit and with Watson Studio and OpenScale to say, hey, your model is starting to drift away from, you know, from mathematical patterns that it would normally expect. Do you want to try and fix this? You've got to address things like that with people, process, and technology, because discrimination is systemic, right? We've heard this a lot in recent times. Racism is systemic, which means it's built into the systems we have. Unless we fix the systems, we will not change the outcomes. We've got to fix the systems. And in every company, it's always people, process, and technology together.
That's really great. And you're not just a client, you're also the club president in the sense that you've written a book, AI for Marketers, an Introduction and Primer, which would you still say is a good place for folks to go learn more about what we're talking about?
That's a good starting point. I actually am going to probably do a third edition. That's the second edition. And I want to spend a lot more time on the bias aspect because I think it's an important part that's overlooked. The stuff that's in there right now, for the most part, is still okay. A lot has changed in the most advanced applications of AI, like natural language processing and natural language generation. But again, for the average marketer who's just getting started, that's a ways off still. It's like, you know, a lot's changing in you know, super fancy laser surgery tools, and you're sitting there with a scalpel going, I'm pretty sure that's not my problem as you know, a first-year medical student.
Well, so now here is like the biggest, the most important question here, right? I don't want to put you on the spot here, Chris, but the people want to know, what is your favorite martial arts movie?
Favorite martial arts movie? Gosh.
I mean, as a ninja, I have to know.
Well, here's the thing. Ninjutsu, if you practice it well, should be really boring, right? When you watch it, it's like, oh no, that person fell down. Whoops. And then the movie's over. You're like, what happened? Well, you know, he fell down and the person, as he was helping pick him up, you know, picked his pocket, took the USB drive that had all the secret information on it. And they got it. It's like spy movies. Spy movies should never be as exciting as they are, because if a spy is doing his job right, you should never have explosions and jumping out of hotel rooms and stuff. It should be really boring. Like, huh, I guess I misplaced that file folder. And the movie's over like 2 seconds.
Yeah.
But martial arts movies, I mean, there's so many. There's the classics, you know, Bruce Lee's movies are instant classics because of just of the amount of skill that he has as a practitioner. Those are fun. And then some of the, just the very fanciful ones, like a lot of the Chinese wushu movies are just so much fun. They completely defy physics. Like there's no sense whatsoever. Probably the one that is the most interesting and thought provoking is one that got very little press in the West. Here it was called Hero. It was a Jet Li movie, and
Hero.
It was like Rashomon, right? It's a four different perspectives, and you, at the end, you kind of go, which one was the actual truth?
I loved Hero. I'm trying to remember where I ended up seeing a preview of it or something like that, and I had a pattern of, you know, I'd hear about a movie and I wouldn't know when they were going to be released. And at that time we didn't have Netflix or whatever it is. So I'd end up going to eBay and buying DVDs that I could play here that were from Asia. I couldn't remember exactly where they were sending them from over there. The great thing about it is that they would cost just as much as the DVDs here, but they would be in the most beautiful packaging because of the cost of printing and all that stuff. And so I actually have a really beautiful copy of Hero. It's all, I think, Chinese, and it's this amazing, beautiful packaging. I always had to just make sure that I could get the copy with subtitles on it, or I wouldn't know what the heck was going on. But yeah, Hero is a really incredible movie. Well, Chris, man, now I'm so interested in talking with you about some of those other topics that we were talking about, especially the bias aspect of it with data. That's such a fascinating thing for folks to know. Where can people learn more about you and stay in touch?
Two places that are easy. One, go to trustinsights.ai. That's my company. And we've got a blog, podcast, the usual stuff that you expect. And the second is my personal blog, christophersspenn.com. And you can find your way to all the other social channels and stuff everywhere else from there. But those two places, trustinsights.ai and christophersspenn.com.
You guys should really check out Chris from time to time. Will do something where he's tuning up his website or doing something and let everybody tag along and watch it. I don't know if I know that you and I are connected on Facebook, so I've seen that from time to time. I would imagine you've got that available in other places where you can stream your video as well.
Yep, it's called Saturday Night Data Parties. Right now they're on Facebook Live. I'm actually going to start playing with some of the multicasting systems and see if I can do a couple of different, you know, like Facebook and YouTube Live at the same time.
So people should check it out. It's very interesting to see it all being done in real time there. Chris, I hope that I can have you back again. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, you made it to the end. Thank you for listening to the Marketing in the Raw podcast. I'm super happy that you spent time with us. If you could do one thing, it would be incredible if you could subscribe to this podcast. And if you've already done so, then kudos to you. If you found anything interesting in this podcast that you think a colleague might like, then I really recommend that you share it with them, send it to them in an email, or even, you know, just share it with your social networks. It helps us get out there and spread the word. Last but not least, if you wanted to connect with me in any way, ask some questions about digital marketing, you've got a problem you need us to solve, or just in general want to connect, you can find me at adam@secretsushi.com. That's my email. Or just visit us at secretsushi.com. Thanks. Take care.